Hey, everybody. You know, I was thinking movie theaters would make great supermarkets. High ceilings, wide doors. You just rip out the seats, throw in some freezers, and you're good to go. Because let's face it, nobody's going to movies anymore. Who wants to sit through 4 hours of trailers and take out a mortgage to buy popcorn and soda? Now, there's a better way to get movies and TV shows. I want to tell you about a great website where you'll find thousands of movies and TV shows at incredible prices. It's deepdiscount.com. Everything on the site is discounted. It's great. I just bought 3 movies on it. And they're low, low prices. Click their logo on my website and you'll see what I mean. Just go to paulmercurio.com. It's right on my homepage. And all this month, be sure to look for coupon codes and icons for even more savings on Blu-rays, comedy, and complete TV series too. Look, stop wasting time searching and searching to find your favorites on your cable system. You know how that ends up. Arguments, and then you're in a loveless marriage. All right, that got a little personal, but you know what I mean. Take charge. Go buy it. No more commercials. No more edits. No more bad streams that buffer all the time. Buy the shows you want to watch and own them forever. Pass them down in the will. Why not? At deepdiscount.com, you'll find classics, hard-to-find titles, and new releases, too. Coming out this week, great movie, Molly's Game, based on the true story of Molly Bloom, an Olympic-class skier who ran the world's most exclusive, high-stakes, underground poker game in the world. Get your copy on DVD and Blu-ray for a great, great price at deepdiscount.com. Listen, I just got Fletch, I just got Caddyshack, and Godfather. Amazing prices, classic movies. Look, click their logo on my website and check it out. Just go to paulmercurio.com. It's on the homepage. Be good to yourself. Buy your favorites, old and new. Watch what you want to watch when you want it. You deserve it. Thank you, Deep Discount. All right, I got to get to my guest. Because this guest represents why I do this podcast. I love to talk to people about process, especially people who are at the pinnacle of what they do, and especially artists. And this guy is all of these things. Frank Oz, the Muppet creator of such characters as Miss Piggy, Fozzie Bear, Cookie Monster, director who's worked with such actors as Marlon Brando, Robert De Niro, Edward Norton, Steve Martin, Michael Caine. He's directed these guys in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, The Score, Little Shop of Horrors. And this is just such a cool conversation about process and how the Muppet characters are created and working with these amazing actors. And I'm so excited about it and so honored. This guy is iconic, and I don't overuse that word. Enjoy Frank Oz.
Are we good?
All right. I'm very excited about this.
Oh.
I am.
It's going to be a tremendous letdown for you.
No, it's not. You sound like me. I'm all about... Okay, we're starting now. I'm very informal the way we start. This is where we'll start it, somewhere around here. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is a very special edition for me. I have my son with me because I wanted my son to meet this iconic human being, artist, director... puppeteer. You might know him as the person behind, among others, Miss Piggy, Fozzie Bear, Cookie Monster, Grover, and amazing director of movies like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and many others, Frank Oz.
Thank you. Hi.
It's so great to meet you.
Nice to be here.
Did you get
your son out of here first?
Yeah, exactly. He's a pain in the ass, isn't he? You know, what did I make you do right before you came? I saw my son Alex off mic, but I made you do what for you? I said, you're not going to go looking like that, right?
What would you look like before?
Oh.
Yeah. I would have been cool for me. I don't care.
And he, would you get up? You got up at the crack of what, 12:30? Fourth day in a row.
Oh, yeah.
And this was, he went to bed early last night because
Wait. You got to explain. Give him a break. Cut some slack. He's on spring break.
Yeah, that's
true. So you got to cut some slack.
That's true.
Yep. I went to bed at 12:30.
Right. Right. And did you leave the house yesterday? We left the house to get pizza. That was it. And then you came back. Oh yeah, it's exhausting.
It's spring break. Spring break is like landing on the safety in Monopoly. You know, whatever
exactly. You can do,
whatever you're all safe, whatever you want.
Could be running around in some country.
What? Smuggling drugs? What are you talking about?
Or Florida, or I could be home. So I'd rather be home. And
all right. I don't know if anybody's hearing any of him, but a little bit. That's good. Well, Frank, thank you so much for being on the show.
Is it over?
It's done. I'm sorry, we don't have any time now for you. You have a really fascinating documentary out that's called Muppet Guys Talking,
yeah,
which is this just fascinating collection of original Muppet performers, Jerry Nelson, Fran Brill, Dave Goles, Bill Beretta, and you,
yeah,
sort of talking about process,
yeah,
and how things got done. And this is sort of gives me goosebumps because the reason I do this podcast is I'm fascinated by process.
Me too.
I've been fortunate enough to have Paul McCartney on the show to talk to him about how he makes music, and Bryan Cranston in film. And I'm just a geek about that stuff. And I think that there's a shortage of long form interview shows out there where you can really delve deep into great artists like yourself. You know, a lot of times you go on the late shows and they got seven artists to sell their stuff. You
yeah.
know? Seven minutes to sell their stuff.
No question. Yeah. And any interviews, you're 3-4 minutes. You record for half an hour and you're down to 3-4 minutes. But, you know, that's the nature of the business. I agree. I could talk about craft all day long.
Yes. Well, good. You're going to.
It's just it's the, you know, all the regular questions that I get from everybody. I've just done about 36 interviews for Muppet Guys Talking. The trouble with that is every time one asks the same question over and over.
Mm.
The first time one has to be truthful.
Mm.
The second time you try and be truthful.
Right.
And in order to be truthful, you have to answer it the same way the first time.
Right.
And it's the same answer over and over again. Right. And there's nobody to be fresh.
Right. Well, we're going to try to avoid that.
Okay.
What have you not mentioned in the context of this that you'd like to talk about? I usually don't do this, but because of what I know what I want to ask you, but because of what you just said, is there something that you've been wanting to talk about in the context of what, you know, this film is about and what you do?
Well, as far as, you know, the film is about, it's a Trojan horse to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
The funny and the clips and all the talking about how to create characters and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is the horse, which is fantastic. We love doing that. We had a great time. But inside that horse, we hope by osmosis or assimilation in some way that people will understand and get a feel of how it is to work together in an inclusive way, in a collaborative way. Like, this is how we work with Jim Henson.
Mm.
I was 19 when I joined Jim, and it's the only job I've ever had. And so for me, it was normal to be collaborative, inclusive, to have a lot of fun, work like a son of a bitch. You know, all those things, and yet have fun and care about each other.
That comes through in spades throughout. You all mention it. And Fran talks about, she uses the terms, you're able to fail and be silly, and you're in a safe space. You were 19. What year was that?
1963.
Okay. Part of that for me, and I talked to Paul McCartney about this too, is sort of, and he was very nice to me when I approached him. I do think that your time, life is about context, right? I worked in TV shows that have not been all the time that supportive and collaborative. Sometimes just the opposite, very competitive and backstabbing.
Right, exactly.
Is part of it the culture of the time? The 60s were a much more sort of forgiving time and less competitive in some way?
In that context, maybe the 60s, you know, the United States was having a nervous breakdown with all the rules broken because kids just got tired of it, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was everything was a bubble. Everything was not a bubble, but one word, a bubble.
Yeah.
And it was a time of great flux.
Right.
So it might be that's the case, but I guess I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I guess no matter what time period one is in, I believe it's the person that makes the difference. And I think Jim Henson would have been the same here in this time period as he was in the other, which is a very singular individual.
Mm-hmm. And what brought you together at 19? How did you come to?
He saw me at 17 years old doing a show, and then when I was 19, I wanted to be a journalist, and he asked me to come to New York for 6 months to try it part-time, and I just stayed with him.
To be a puppeteer. Yeah.
Yeah. To be, at that time, we didn't have Sesame Street. At that time, we were doing like dozens and dozens of rehearsal of commercials mm-hmm. and every variety show you could name.
And did you make your own early on? Were you making your own puppets?
Yeah. When I was a weird kid. I was like 12 years old to about 17, 18. I do birthday party shows in my in Oakland, California area. Mm. And I'd make them. It's not that I wanted to be a puppeteer. It's just that was the best way to express myself safely. I can say that now looking back upon
yeah.
it. But my parents, it was their hobby.
Uh-huh.
And so it was just there for me.
Mm.
And as an adult, I've realized that I was very shy and self-deprecating and mm-hmm. had low self-esteem. And so that was a perfect way for me to express myself without feeling any rejection.
Right. You're not putting yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did that for quite a while. And then, as I said, when I was 17, he saw the show, but I didn't come to Jim full-fledged. I, like in the documentary, you know, mm-hmm. maybe it's not in the documentary. I'm not sure. Maybe in the out footage that the first job I had, the first thing Jim asked me to do was to go fill the fire extinguisher across town.
Yeah, so, I didn't see that in the documentary.
Yeah, it's in some of the extra footage that we have, yeah.
Yeah. What you talk about a lot, not a lot, but your process of sort of creating these characters, which I know you've touched on, is very akin to, you know, I act, and it's the same process of, you know, there's this misnomer that you guys are voiceover people, which you're not. And you create these characters, but then you have backstory for each of these characters, right? Which is what actors do.
Yeah, not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some that I do, but some don't deserve a backstory.
Such
like
as?
Animal.
Yeah.
There's not much.
yeah, I could see
there's
that.
Not much backstory to Animal. He's too primeval, you know?
That's a good point. It's sort of.
So it depends on the character.
Right. Well, with Miss Piggy, I mean, you've talked about, you know, there are. It actually started with Richard Hunt for two shows, and then sort of it had a hoity-toity way of sort of expressing herself, but then that sort of changed through rehearsal.
It was a time when the Muppet Show in the first few years, you know, as you know, one in shows, as you know very well, one takes time to gel and become liquid, you know, and so you try things. And Miss Piggy at that time was done by Richard Hunt and me. And then I said to Richard, hey, Richie, I got this idea. And he says, yeah, I have no idea. So go ahead, take her.
Mm. You know? And you talk about that in that character, and Bill talked about this. You all talked about sort of how pieces of you or your backstory or people that you know tend to sort of become part of that character's background. Yeah. So like I love the story for King Prawn that I think it was Bill's wife's aunt kept saying, finished everything with okay, okay.
It's brilliant.
So he brought it in.
Yeah.
And then he was being asked to describe the character to maybe a writer, and he said it's shellfish, and he meant to say selfish. So it turned, that
isn't
just
that amazing?
Blew my mind.
Me too. I had no idea. You know, I found out stuff like that. I had no idea.
And now I'm going to ask you, you did look surprised when you heard that.
Yeah, well, we've been interviewed dozens and dozens of times individually.
Right.
But never together.
Right.
And so we found out about things that I didn't know about these guys. I mean, how many times, like in the writing room of Daily Show, do you all get together and talk about the experience?
Yeah,
you don't.
That's true.
You know?
You're on sort of
and
path.
It's really wonderful when you do it.
Yeah.
You don't realize.
And you... you know, imbued in sort of Miss Piggy, you say, is some of your own insecurities and
at that time, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. At that time, I was my 20s. Mm. I was in my 30s. We had just done the first year of Saturday Night Live, and then we went to London. So, yeah, I was in my 30s, and I still was uncertain of myself. I was an unformed personality.
What were you uncertain about? It seemed like you were a performer and you were...
No, I think you know very well that this stuff runs deep, and that's low self-esteem and that sense of shyness in real life doesn't go away very easily. It's in your hard drive.
Yeah.
And so it continues until you kind of work it out. I've worked it out, fortunately.
Mm-hmm.
but it's taken a long time. Mm. And so it always sticks with each of us.
Was that, did you ever figure out what the source of that insecurity was, or was it just DNA?
I think it was for me anyway. I think I was not myself as a kid. I always had to please, I always felt I had to please my parents.
Oh, I felt that about my mother.
Yeah. So in order, and so as a result, when one pleases too much, one covers oneself up.
Yeah.
So that I think was part of it.
Yeah. You know? And then the character develops, as Fran said, through improvisation, which I thought was fascinating because that's how I develop my material.
Of course, when you do your stuff and
you're out of your own way and you're just in this.
And I love your comment about Vaseline. I think it's hysterical.
Oh God, you saw that.
Hysterical.
Thank you.
God, I thought this, again, it comes from truth, right?
Can I tell you something? There's some jokes. I think I got this bit about the Last Supper figured out, and it's taken me four or five months. Which is the Last Supper had to be a tense dinner because what are you going to make small talk with Jesus Christ? He's going to get crucified. Like, what would you possibly say to Jesus? Like, you know, it'd be so, I tap into, because I'm Italian and there's a lot of talk around the table. What would you like? Oh, this is terrific hummus, Jesus. and then I just start to talk about how it's exactly what you guys do, which is tap into your own self through the character.
Yeah, you have nothing else to go for.
So I'd say, I probably would then start saying awkward stuff because I don't like silences, right? So I'd be like, Jesus, why are we all sitting on the same side of the table? Is there going to be a hit? Just so I'm clear, this isn't the Last Supper for all of us, correct?
That's great. But that took 4 months, right?
That took four.
Now, you know Mike Birbiglia, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, Mike's a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't understand that all of us take so long. Mike's got this new show I've seen twice now, which is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still, it's good now, but he's still touring.
Which one is is it the Sleep With?
It's a new one, which is brilliant. And I forgot the name.
That's okay. Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
I saw it here in Seattle. Yeah. And he's extraordinary. And he creates this character, obviously, because he's a very smart guy. Mm. But people don't understand, and that's okay. They don't have to understand how hard we work. We don't ask how hard a plumber works, right?
No, I know. I just can't figure out why I can't get this ISIS joke to work. Because I was reading in the New Yorker,
ISIS joke? Go ahead.
I'm tapping in. I'm sorry. We'll move on.
I want to hear the ISIS joke.
No, we're going to talk about your stuff.
I got to hear this friggin' ISIS joke.
There was an article that ISIS is run like a corporation and they have a human resources department. So I just was curious as to how that conversation goes in a human resources department. It's like, I assume that people are like, violating, like, yeah, listen, the other night in the cave, you made an off-color joke that really offended people. And apparently you're letting your wife drive and be educated, which is really offending people. So, as you go down those paths, the process is maddening and exhilarating.
It's hard because you're right on that razor's edge.
That's exactly right.
You know.
And the point of the Vaseline thing was, the reason I brought this up, is that got written in literally like a day and a half.
Yeah.
So some stuff comes right away.
Doesn't. When it's right, it's right.
Right. And so, have you found your characters, it seems like from the documentary, that a lot of the characters do evolve over time and change. Like Fran talks about Little Pink, who Little Pink is this very demure, whatever, and then
I used to work her, as a matter of fact, yeah.
Yeah.
On the Ed Sullivan show, yeah.
Yeah. How does that happen? Is it because that you grow as a person?
No, that didn't evolve as much as when we did the Sullivan show, we did a lot of different acts along with other variety shows. So Little Pink at that time was somebody I used in a 3-minute number.
Mm.
Then when Sesame Street rolled along and Fran joined us in the second year, third year, I don't know, Jim then needed a character and he just changed that, you know, what I was doing and make it into her character because it was not a well-known character that anybody would have problems with changing.
So
it didn't evolve. Mm-hmm. It stopped and then started all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then she talked about sort of how it got bossy over time, for lack of a better term.
Well,
right?
It becomes like your stuff. You can't avoid who you are.
Right, right.
It's whatever you do. And if it doesn't come from inside one, in my opinion, it's going to be surface. You can't impose stuff on characters. It's got to come from inside. In my opinion.
Right, and I think that speaks to. You know, I obviously, you know, it's iconic the show and what you all have done and do there. But I think that that process and how deep it goes is the reason that it's so long lasting. And it's not just these surface characters that sort of feel like bubblegum and then you move on. I call it like, or like if it's a joke, it's I call it like McDonald's comedy where you hear it and then 10 minutes later, you don't really remember. It's like you're hungry again after you've eaten. But that all is from the ground up. In other words, it doesn't sound like you all sat around and said, this is how we have to do it. It just sort of was imbued in all of you as you came through those doors.
You know, mainly Jim. I mean, Jim was a leader of everything. And although as he was a leader, he was also a co-worker. He worked harder than anybody else.
Right.
And this all stemmed from Jim's sensibility, the sensibility of having fun, working like a son of a bitch, being rebellious, being anarchic in such a way that we can use it to be funny. You know, when we improv, and you know this very well, people think improv, oh, just talk. Well, improv means discipline. One has to know the arc of where we go on. You got to know the character. You got to know, you know, you not step on somebody else's jokes. And so when we say improv, we mean it in a very disciplined way.
Right.
And so in the same sense, The Muppet Show was kind of a controlled lunacy because it had to be in order to work, you know, it had to shoot a show every 3 days.
Right.
So we had to do it. But it really, all that stuff really came from Jim and we, it was such a new way to work. It was just extraordinary because he came from a place from production design. He wanted to be, he was an artist, he was an experimental filmmaker. And so that whole different angle on performing in puppets came from him because he came from an innocence. And I've said this before, so forgive me, but one of the mantras I live by now is I had talked about name dropping. I'm not trying to, but it's just what happened. Orson Welles was in our movie for a day, and then Orson asked me and Jim.
Who's a big influence? Touch of You was a big influence for you, right?
Big influence. As a B movie, I think it's fantastic. You know, it's incredible. How do you know that?
I do research. My wife helps me. We get all this stuff, right? Mom helps.
So Orson said some amazing things across the table, but one thing I'll never forget, which is he said, most people create out of experience and I create out of innocence.
Huh.
And that's kind of been, that I think is how Muppets came about. It came from an innocence and not depending on empirical knowledge. And
meaning you sort of have you're open to all possibilities.
Always open to possibilities. And Jim, of course, we're dealing with a very special person where Jim, talking about Jesus and small talk, Jim didn't do small talk. Did small talk.
Was he very much an introvert and in his head?
He was an introvert, but every time he talked, it was about a project he was excited about.
Really?
I mean, certainly he'd talk about his family and things like that, but he'd never waste time doing small talk and gossip and everything. He'd be very kind to people and talk to them when they want to, but if he had his druthers, it was just about exciting projects.
Was he able to separate his work when he left the studio and sort of separated from his life? And are you able to? Because I find like with jokes, they kind of stay with me all the time. They're always in the back of my head. Oh, maybe I could add something. Does that happen with you with the characters?
No, I didn't take it home. I didn't want to, I didn't want to be the special one at home. My kids needed the attention, not me.
Right.
So I never took it home.
Right. And were there projects or characters that you sort of you felt you had something but just couldn't grab either you or any of your coworkers and co-artists to sort of you just hit a wall you just have to drop it or what would be some of those examples or
something? We have a whole what we call dead Muppets. Because
it's so funny, I had Jerry of Ben and Jerry's on recently, and they have a graveyard of dead flavors. One was peanut butter and jelly.
Really?
Yeah, and it's actually virtual. The graveyard's online, and it's also
if you go
visit the fact there's like these little headstones. So
we all have dead parts of our professions.
Exactly.
And our dead part. I mean, I had a character called Harvey Kneeslapper, which didn't work at all. And somebody else, Franny had Howie the Rabbit, didn't work at all. I had Professor Hastings, which didn't work at all. I mean, those are all part of the gallery.
How do you know when they're not working?
Because it, you know, when the writers don't write for you that much in that character.
Yeah.
When I'm not breaking up my fellow guys with a character.
Yeah.
When it's not clicking, when it's not bubbling, you know.
Mm.
You know.
How much are you improvising off of what's written, you know, as an actor sort of, there's this unwritten rule, you don't improvise unless the director says it's okay. But even if you do, you got to kind of stay within the structure of what's written and not get too far afield. I mean, were there any unwritten rules about that, or how did that
No,
work?
I mean, as a director, I value improvisation.
Mm.
I want improvisation depending upon the rhythms of the words,
mm-hmm.
because if you improv, you're naturalistic.
Mm-hmm.
If the words are a bit more stylized and more rhythmic, then you can't really improv because we're naturalistic.
Right.
As a performer, you know, Jim is always the one who instigated having fun. He was always the one. So, for instance, Bert and Ernie, we would always have scripts,
mm-hmm.
but then we'd usually screw around in rehearsals and play around there, and then kind of, you know, there's a back, as you know, there's a little editor in your mind saying, "Hey, that might work."
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so then we would put on the air, and sometimes on the air we just say screw it and ad lib too, because you work from the moment, right?
Right.
If
which is very exciting.
It's the best way to work.
Yeah.
So we always work with a script,
mm-hmm.
and I think it depends on who knows what. It
mm-hmm.
depends on when you woke up that morning. Depends on the script. Depends on whatever it is that one really just either improvs or does what the script is.
Right.
We rarely did what the script said, rarely.
You rarely did what the script said.
Because there's always about 10-15% to keep it alive, and that's the improvisation.
Right.
But we're always intent, you know, we always know we have a job to do. We always have an improvisation. We have a discipline about it, you know?
Well, you talk about sort of your rehearsal in writing. You talk about you had a scene as Miss Piggy where you're supposed to slap.
Yeah.
I mean, instead, you karate chop, and you found something about Miss Piggy in that moment.
Yeah, it was probably a third show or something like that, and I think a fourth show, and
mm-hmm.
Piggy was starting to get formed right at the very beginnings of it. And in rehearsal, the script called for her to slap Kermit.
Right.
And again, one goes with, you know, you go with your feelings. And instead of that, I just hauled off and karate chopped him.
And to this day, you don't know why you
did it,
right?
No idea why.
Right.
I think it's because I would imagine it was out of honesty, because I have a feeling that if he hurt her enough for a slap, I think probably at that time, what he said was probably more hurtful than a slap. Probably more hurtful, and a slap wouldn't have done it for her. So I probably worked to that honesty.
And maybe this, and that's tied into some of her insecurities, right?
Oh, yeah.
And fed by that.
Absolutely. And so that slap helped me, because Piggy came around during the time of Women's Lib.
Right.
And nothing was intellectually planned, but it just happened when you're performing, you're in an environment. It just comes into your pores.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, she was partly the kind of woman that men wanted, being coy and sweet and elegant and long hair and everything. And then there's another part of her that doesn't take shit.
Right.
You know, and that part she has to cover, like most women have to cover.
Right.
But she's not going to cover it. Gilda Radner came, as a matter of fact. Gilda, when she was on the show, she said, "Oh, I wish I was Miss Piggy." Because as a woman, you have to cover that, right?
Yes.
And so not as much now, but still now.
Right.
And then much more so. So having Miss Piggy underneath, tough as nails, but outside covering it, being sweet and coy, that helped me a lot in creating her.
And there's a lot of depth, a lot of stuff to play with. Is that what made her, you described her, most are two-dimensional, but her three-dimensional?
Yeah. There's a lot behind her for me. I mean, and also I've got to reach down for whatever feminine part that is in me, you know?
Yeah.
She's probably the hardest one I have to work at, but satisfying.
So as a male doing a female, would you ever talk to your wife or a franny or like, would you ever sort of get a perspective to help?
Nah, I just, so you know, Spike Milligan, Spike was on the show. And at that time it was huge, but nobody knew who Piggy was. It's just, it's not that I was hiding. It's just that, you know, I was working. And Spike, we were doing the read through it. We were doing the read through on a Sunday, which we usually do. Mm. And it got finally to the part of Miss Piggy, and I started talking in Piggy's voice, and Spike stood up, pointed at me, and says, "It's a man."
he suspected, and then he confirmed it.
Yeah, I know. I can't with my characters. It seems as though it all has to come from inside and not from outside. I can't look at a person and say, "I'll use that." Somehow it comes from inside only.
What about observing? You know, sometimes I find, like, I'll just observe people, not because I go and say, "Okay, I'm going to go write a joke." By observing somebody, I just see a behavior, I see a thing, or I'm, you know, the way I can almost tell when someone's on a first date in the way their body language is and the what they're talking about in their. Did you find yourself doing that and bringing that into character?
I do that for behavior, but it's different than character to me.
So, for example,
behavior is what one sees on the outside,
right?
And so, yeah, I do that. I mean, I look at people and not even thinking about it and sense their body positions.
Like Fozzie, you might give Fozzie a little something, basically.
But I don't do it intellectually. I don't. It's just by, I guess. Mm-hmm. Just everyday seeing, but I don't think about that.
Yeah.
But but to me, that's not character. To me, that's behavioral.
Right.
Because I saw somebody behave that way. Right. I don't know what they really are like.
Right, right, right.
They may never behave like that ever again, but I saw that.
Right.
You know?
In terms of the directing that you moved into, and you talked about Touch of Evil and sort of why that was such an influential film, like, expand on that a little bit for me, sort of like what was it about that really grabbed you?
Well, actually, it was not only Touch of Evil. It was also Orson did with Kafka. I forgot the name of the movie. It escapes me, but he did extraordinary things. It was boring part of the time, but extraordinary things. But like Touch of Evil, this lighting, this extraordinary contrasting lighting.
You talk about him breaking rules and sort
that's
of.
That's what he did always. He didn't like rules. As a matter of fact, he said to me, he said, "I don't like being called a professional. It sounds like a soldier."
Right. You said, I think it opened up my view of film. There's so much more that could be done. Actually, by breaking so many rules, he allowed other people to say, "Hey, I can maybe think of stuff too."
Yeah.
He just opened up possibilities.
Well, look at those angles. It's so much shooting up. Also,
yes. Yeah.
You know, and giving power and all those choices were not necessarily in normal films.
Mm.
You know, you don't really see that in the normal films that I saw at the time. I've seen other films since then, but he was young. I mean,
I know.
Go back to Citizen Kane.
I know.
I was 20 freaking six.
So was it the industry sort of just was it jealous and didn't want to acknowledge a young boy genius, or were they just so many steps behind and he was so far ahead?
I think it's complicated. I think it's Orson's own doing also.
Yeah, he was not the,
easy. I think it's, to the degree that I know him, and I only knew him for a couple of days, but nice talks, I really don't know him. But what I sensed, it was a combination of him and other people.
Knowing a little bit what I know about you now from talking to you about your own insecurities, which we all have and whatever, right? Directing is quite a step into the limelight.
Yeah.
What pushed you in that direction? I mean, you're obviously brilliant at it, but like what?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I said you were brilliant at it.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I think he's Alex, are you writing this down? Alex, you have any questions? You're the youth of America, by the way. He's thinking about his girlfriend.
Oh, of course.
How long have you been dating now?
Year and a half.
Why the hell are you here?
She's at school.
Okay, fine.
She's at USC.
Oh, great.
Yeah, long distance.
Long distance.
He said, I don't have a shot with her. It goes, you hear all those big football players. She's this cute blonde girl. We're going to break. You kind of said that.
You know, it used to be that. It used to be that. It's not that anymore.
I know.
Yeah, when I was school, the jocks won, but now not anymore.
Yeah, it's a whole different time period.
Yeah. Yeah, directing, I
by the way, you're brilliant at it. Hang on a second. What's that? Yes. I agree. He's brilliant at it, Frank Oz. Why just shorten your name to Oz?
Because when I came,
Osnowitz.
And legally, it's still Osnowitz on my passport. My kids are Osnowitz, everything. But I, Jim and I, when I came in 1963, 64, we did a show called, a weekly show called The Jimmy Dean Show, which is a first country western show.
Jimmy Dean Sausage?
Yeah.
First
country western.
I remember him. He was a big star.
We had all the guest stars, country stars, from Homer and Jethro to, you name it. It was there. So Jim and I would take a bow afterwards internally, not on the screen, but on in front of the audience. And Jimmy couldn't pronounce my name. So Don Saline, who was one of the original four performers, Muppet guys, he made the Muppets. He fabricated them. He said, well, just make it Oz. So that was all it was. So I just use it. I tell my kids it's my phony baloney stage name.
And so when you started directing, was it just this feeling like you want to branch out, you need other creative outlets, or like what was that sort of?
Yeah, I never wanted to be a puppeteer, ever. As I said earlier on, I wanted to be a journalist. But the truth is, I was too scared to say that and this is in the documentary too, I believe. I can't tell. Just as an aside, I've been going through the what happens in, it sounds like I'm doing a plug, but I guess it is a semi-plug. MuppetGuysTalking.com is where you can get the movie.
Right.
And actually today is the last day for this this special offer where you can also get extra footage.
Okay.
And so I've been going through all this extra footage.
Mm-hmm.
I took it aside, but I
Oh, we were just talking about sort of the why'd you step up to do directing, and you were
rats. Anyway, I must have seen something in extra footage that reminded me of what you asked.
Mm-hmm.
But the directing was something. Yeah, I didn't really want to be a puppeteer. To me, it was limiting.
Right,
and I was too frightened to say I wanted to be a director. But eventually, I gave myself 10 years to learn how to direct, and I, learned everything I could, and I was fortunate enough to be shooting movies and commercials and things, and I would learn essentially on the street, not in school.
I was going to say, and what were you picking up from? And by the way, we were talking about you thought about being a journalist. What derailed you from that? I don't mean that in a bad way, but like,
I think because, and a writer, because what I loved is the idea of just sitting with my cardigan and a pipe and thinking about writing. And I realized, oh, wait a second, you actually have to write.
you wanted to sniff your brandy.
I'm like, yeah, I thought, I'm going to be a writer. I like the image of the writer. And I realized, yeah, but I can't write.
there's that. I could see you like working on a manuscript and you hand it in and your publisher goes, this is completely blank. Well, it's all in my head.
Actually, what I've learned, I wrote one script, Muppets Take Manhattan, but after that I realized it. But at that time, Sid Field was right next to the script.
Oh, wow. My book. Sid Field's a famous,
not him, but the book.
The book, yeah. The famous book about writing.
But since then, I've realized I can't write from the blank page. What I do very well is I edit. So when I've worked all the writers, I always work as an editor with them. But in any case, I gave myself 10 years to be a director, and I'm trying to learn as much as I could wherever I was.
Including camera side lenses and all of that?
No, lenses just as much.
How to tell the story visually.
And, yeah, but also, I think it was not an intellectual learning as much as kind of being open and aware of all these things. And
also the mystery is out of it. I mean, I just think, I look back now and having worked on TV shows for a while, I know how to kind of run a TV show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not that I formally had that job most of the time, but when it's not foreign to you, it's not this secret dark, you just go, oh, that's how you got to do A, and then that has to happen over there, and this has to happen.
Yeah. Well, I Jim cut my 10-year goal short by about 4 years or so because he asked me to direct Dark Crystal with him.
Yeah.
And that kind of started my whole directing career, right. You know.
And it was nice, because I wanted to ask you this, sort of being able to do that with him is sort of a...
Yeah, you know, we were so close. And again, this is Jim's movie, not my movie. He asked me to co-direct with him, but he didn't care about credit. He just cared about the quality of the thing. And so the fact that he gave me credit didn't matter to him. Right. But we were very close. And even close, there was me, this first time I've ever directed a movie with Jim, and first time Jim has ever directed a movie. And it was like a friggin' $200 million movie.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So
that would, I don't mean this in a bad way. I don't know that would happen today, that they're so risk averse.
Oh, it wouldn't.
Give two newer directors.
Well, maybe on, I think, you know, it's complicated in Hollywood these days. It's a whole different way. I feel bad people coming up in Hollywood these days because it's just not the same.
Right.
And I don't want to get into that. That's a whole, I mean, nothing, it's not a negative thing. It's facing the reality of what it is now under the corporations, you know. But in any case, yeah, it wouldn't happen today.
Right.
You know, although some of the Marvel stuff, I think they will allow some directors there.
Yeah, they're tapping into some commercial directors too. They're sort of that sort of younger eye or whatever.
One question is to what degree they're in control of the movie. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Could be, hopefully all.
Right. But here you are in this movie directing with Jim. And
yeah.
And it's nice to have each other, I would imagine, given that it was, you obviously have an incredible collaborative working relationship already.
Yeah.
And to be able to walk into a movie of that size with somebody shoulder to shoulder must have felt good.
Yeah. I don't know if you work with somebody, maybe, I don't know who you work with, but our relationship is, you know, we do a take on whatever show we're doing and we look at each other and we didn't have to talk. We just knew we'd have to do the takeover again for whatever reason we knew it.
Well, I bet you're a good director because you're an actor in a sense, and you sort of, you understand what good direction is. You know, sometimes you get direction like be bigger or whatever.
I still make big mistakes. I remember, it's not on the Muppet guys talking. This is outside it, but I remember doing the score with Brando and De Niro and Edward Norton. And I remember...
I really liked that movie.
Oh, thank you very much.
I really did.
Thank you. And Edward was shooting a scene. I get excited. So I'll go up right... So I went right up to him after the first take. And I said, hey, Edward, I'm thinking... And Edward said, Frank, could you just let me try it? Just let me try it, okay? And he was absolutely right.
You mean this was... He had already done the scene.
He'd done one take.
And he wanted to try something.
He wanted to try some other. And I went up to him and interrupted that thought process, whatever that process is, was inside for him. And he was right. He was absolutely right. And so I pulled back and let him do, and I could feel when he was over it, and then I came in. But the problem with me with a score was I had done so many comedies, and I always needed to make the joke work, so I'd always come in. I'd always come in with Steve or with Eddie Murphy or something. I'd always come in and make the joke work.
Right.
And that was early in the shooting, and I realized, oh, I got to pull back and observe more.
Right. And so with De Niro and Brando, who are, you know, obviously masters at what they do, were they fairly collaborative with you, or did you have to be fairly hands-off with them because they sort of have their process and their thing?
No, Bob, bless him, is absolutely wonderful. Marlon, I could go on for a long time. Marlon hated my guts.
Why? You seem like such a fine man, young, nice person.
Not really inside, no.
Yeah, I get that sense. You kind of give off a vibe.
But you buy it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You're so full of shit, it's coming out of your ears. I didn't think I'd ever say that to Frank Oz, but I'm really excited now. No.
It's very complicated, but just it came from the fact that it started with, I went to Marlon's home and we talked for a couple of hours.
About the character?
No, actually, we talked about everything but the character.
Was this for him to get to know you, or you to get to know him, or
me to know him and see if he wanted to do the role? And he talked about everything else but the character. Mm. There's a lot of things on there. A lot of things he said and a lot of things that happened. But when we, I did say, hey, we should probably talk about this character now. And Marlon wanted to, he said, I just feel like he should be gay. I said, okay, fine, but not overtly. And he said, no, no, it's just very delicate. Because I had
I mean, truly gay or just effeminate?
Gay.
Did he give you a reason why? Because I know the character, and I'm not... In the context of the movie, that wouldn't jump out as me as something you'd want to have, but what was his rationale?
There was no rationale. I didn't ask him. And if a character actor wants to do something, if it's subtle, if it doesn't hurt the situation, I'm fine.
And you wanted it to be subtle because you didn't want it to become overtake...
It's not that. If it was not subtle, it wouldn't work in the story because the character that Bob De Niro played was always under the radar. Mm. He wouldn't work with somebody who was flamboyant.
Yes.
Because then it would bring attention to the thing.
You can't have a Nathan Lane kind of
can't do
there.
It because it would bring attention to him, and then all of a sudden possibly people could find out he's more than a nightclub owner.
Right.
And I had already done a movie called In and Out with Kevin Kline and such about a gay guy, gay teacher. And I didn't want to, I felt a responsibility to that community not to make fun of anybody. Mm. And so I said, okay, cool. But he came on the set and it was like Truman Capote. It was way over the top.
Oh.
And my editor said, we can't use this, Frank. I said, I know we can't. And so I had to be tough on Marlon. And I said, I wouldn't let him do that. And from that point on, things got bad.
Did you get him to give you what you need? I mean, it seems
he gave
like
me what did. I wanted because what I wanted was just him.
Yeah.
There's I remember after being tough with him and then we had a meeting with him and the associate producer, me and Gary Foster, the producer. It was a very tense situation, but he agreed to essentially do what I say. And so when he I was on a tangent. What was it?
You have a you kind of. You wanted just him, you said, and you sit with the associate producer. And...
So I finally had to shut him down and say, you can't do that. It's just not right.
It must have been really hard to even get those words out, huh? Or were you at the point where like you were just fed up?
If you're intimidated by anybody, you shouldn't be directing.
Right.
You know, but I learned great lessons from that. In any case, when he finally just did the scene with Robert, and he was himself. And we leaned over and I said, Marlon, it's great. He says, I don't know what I'm doing. And it worked perfectly.
Meaning he doesn't feel like he's doing enough.
Right. And that was great.
Right.
For me, that was great.
Right. Perfect. That's a lot of times what people say is, I remember doing a take.
And Marlon was very sincere. He wanted to do the best job he could. And he truly believed that was the right character, but it didn't fit.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And anyway, that started for 3 weeks. It was a very tough time.
Was it difficult for you coming out of the Muppets, doing comedies, which great comedies, to get, you know, you tend to get pigeonholed in this business in front and behind the camera and in life, I guess. Was it difficult for you to start to convince people, or did you have to at all, that, hey, I could do drama, I could do action, I could...
I don't believe in convincing. I believe it's got to happen because no one's going to believe you unless they see it, in my opinion.
Right.
So I finally said to my agent, because I'd done so many comedies, and I love doing comedies, but I didn't want to be a one-trick pony, you know?
Right.
And so I said to my agent, I'm going to turn down every single comedy. I'm sorry. I've got to try a drama.
Well, there were any that were just so tough to turn down.
I turned down a lot of stuff. And I got this script, which was not where it should be. I could tell you over beers a whole story about that. But in any case, so I... that's when I did it. And I think the only way people would understand that I'm not a one-trick pony is by them seeing what it is.
Yeah.
That's all.
In a business where it's hard
to you're a lawyer and somebody, and you say, yeah, but I'm really a comedian, they're not going to believe you.
Right.
right?
Right. They have to see it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with, you know, I get to do some dramatic acting now, but it's sort of like you have to
What dramatic acting?
I was Colonel Kurtz in the actual, it's not Brando, that's me doing the, no, I've just.
So you had to grow your hair back?
Yeah, exactly. And I lost a lot of weight, put on a lot of weight, less weight. No, just some small parts. I just had a part in a Lee F. Schreiber movie called Chuck, which is a Chuck Webner story, which is the real life Rocky Balboa.
Right.
And so it's in the, I got a part coming up in another show about late night television, a movie. And so I do find that casting directors see comedian and they just think, okay, well, he can do comedy, but he doesn't really do drama. And so you really have to kind of
and
push
the, truth is,
the agents and the casting directors to see you in that other way.
The truth is we know comedians can do drama and dramatic actors can't do comedy.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, Tom Cruise can. I'm a big fan of Tom Cruise.
Yeah, I know.
He does great, amazing dramatic work. And he does extraordinary comedic work.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever aspire to act straight up at any time?
No, I went to HP Studios when I was in my 20s and for acting, scene study, and technique and all that in order to learn how to speak to actors.
Later. Wow, good for you. Yeah. And a lot of directors do that.
They should.
That's really amazing.
They
yeah. Because it is a very psychological job, right?
It is. And still, no matter what information, what I've learned, Edward would hate me calling him Eddie. I've never called him Eddie. I don't know why I call him Eddie now. But like Edward, I still make mistakes all the time.
Well, you are human. But I mean, I would imagine you going back to the Muppets and your experience of collaborating with, and I wanted to just touch on this briefly, but we'll get to this in a second, but, you know, sort of commenting on the script, editing, you know, sort of working with the writers, you inherently learned how to collaborate with other artists. And I imagine that put you in good stead when you started directing. You were comfortable in that role.
I honestly don't know. If anything, it would, again, come from Jim and the working atmosphere of the Muppets. And again, that's what that Muppet guy's talking is about in a larger sense, although in the narrow sense, it's very funny and, you know, some great, great stories that nobody's ever heard.
Oh, it's great. And then you, then in the juxtaposition with the clips, and then it's yeah. educational and it's really entertaining and it's funny and, you know.
But that sense of collaboration really came from Jim because he always valued our opinion. Didn't always follow it. When I'm directing a movie, I say to people, please come to me with your suggestions.
Right.
But please understand, if I only take 1 out of 10, it's nothing personal.
Right. Well, but you talk about like Johnny Fiamma, which is Bill's character.
Billy's character, brilliant.
Yeah, right. He said it's based on his father and his grandfather.
No.
And I think you said, somebody said that and he plays Frank Sinatra all the time. And I think somebody said,
so
where?
Funny.
And he goes in the car.
It was so sweet because he meant it.
Yeah.
It was so sweet. It was one of
the thing that's going to jump out at people is they're going to see. I'm sorry. I know you talked about this, but that's why you're here. But I'm going to gush about it. I like watching other artists react to an artist, right? So seeing the four of you react to something that someone said, and you looking surprised, you know,
yeah.
and Fran or Bill, it was so fun to watch. It's so fun to watch on so many levels. And what I also found was that the conversation about the actual physical puppet and the contributions that you make with the workshop and talk about that and that interface a little bit and how the look of the puppet might evolve over time was really fascinating to me.
Yeah, you know, the workshop, it was brilliant, and we would always go in and try the character and such, but the workshop is an unsung hero here because the workshop has to make the character in such a way that we can actually work it because it needs to have the balance right and the grip right and everything. And on the outside, have the same kind of, or mirror the design that would feed us.
Right.
As the character wears on, if you have a different idea, they'll change something for you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the workshop is funny. I'm here, and I say this so many times, I'm here, but there should be 50 people around me. There should be writers. There should be workshop people. There should be gym. There right. should be other performers. Right. There should be all these people around me because you don't work in a vacuum.
No, exactly.
And so I'm the guy who's in the limelight now, but I wouldn't be if it wasn't for these other people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand that. It's the same thing with like a star of a sitcom or a late night show or whatever. Yeah. There's staffs of hundreds that sort of, and it's nice of you to say, but I mean, you know, you all kind of need each other.
Absolutely
and
true.
And that environment of that.
Well, you saw that in the Muppet Guys talking.
Yeah, you know? It's true. I mean, you sort of that, what stood out for me was how creatively fertile everybody was, but the environment that Jim created that allowed that to happen.
Absolutely.
And why were you working so hard though? Was it just because you guys were just making it, just trying to get everything perfect?
Yeah.
A couple
of things. One, sometimes we were, you know, in the beginning when it was like four of us and we made the sets and I didn't do very much of it, but, Don Celine did, and we all kind of chipped in and worked till like 3 a.m. or something like that. It's because, you know, like anybody, it's like, why do you write a term paper at the last minute? You know, it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then we'd have to drive to DC to shoot them because we got a deal there.
Mm-hmm.
Then later on, we'd work really hard when it was a big company in London and LA and New York because what Jim wanted was he pushed the envelope so much. Like Storyteller was an amazing TV series, incredible.
Mm.
And so that, in order to get that kind of quality, you worked till 3 or 4 a.m.
Yeah. You were working, obviously PBS, I mean, did you deal with censors or sort of subject matter where you talk about pushing the envelope where they're like, you know what, this is a little too whatever.
Not really. No. What's funny is if a human being said some of the stuff that the characters said, there would be a censor, but the puppets get away with a lot.
Tell you, every John Stewart did the show. I mean, anybody that I know, especially big names as celebrities have done the show, it's so respected, not just by viewers, but fellow artists in the industry. Like that
what's respected?
The being part of the Muppet world as a guest, you know, like coming on the show.
Yeah.
You know, I remember John was really excited about doing it, and you see these huge celebrities that have done the show. You just get the sense that there's because it's a very hard thing that you do. You know, it's sort of, you know, I work on The Daily Show, if you write for Comedy Central, you know, you can kind of go edgy and blue and whatever and this and that, but you guys have always had sort of smart writing that could tap into a 5-year-old and a 50-year-old.
Yeah. It was Jerry Jewell was a head writer. And another thing is that...
And character development along with
sure.
it. It's all well, part it's of the same. But sort of, you know, to create something that a 10-year-old and a 50-year-old could sit in the same room together and enjoy equally
and
is
we
a very hard thing to do.
Of course, the reason is we never thought about the kids.
But that's what I'm wondering.
We thought about ourselves.
How did you figure out how to do that?
We didn't figure it out. We just had fun as adults. That's all. We never thought about kids ever.
Yeah.
So as adults, we just screwed around and within that discipline... and Jerry Jewell was the head writer. On sitcoms today, they have 14 writers.
Yeah.
And we never had more than four, you know?
Wow.
And so it
And that was a good thing. Why?
That was a great thing. Because the vision is clearer, you know? And Jim, of course, was the main one.
Right.
And Jerry Jewell was the main one. But there were disparate ideas within the four. But... there was also a feeling of, because of Jim, a feeling of just camaraderie, no jealousy, no backstabbing, no politics, only one thing counted, and that's doing a good job. And I think when you get a lot of people in a room, everybody's vying for attention.
Well, yeah, I saw it. I mean, we would literally have, I mean, there was a fist fight one time with another writer over a joke. And then you step back and I look back now and it's like, over a joke, really? But like it would get, now some would argue that that's good because it creates competition or whatever, but it's like,
That's bullshit. And, you know, what was interesting when Jim died, call it a celebration, was, I forgot where it was, but there was a bishop. And he talked about Jim. He never met Jim. But what he said was extraordinary, which is, as we know in the business, that, you know, when you play an evil person or a bad person, it's much more interesting than playing a good person.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And yet, all these people in the Muppet Show were good.
Yes.
And they were still fascinating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that has a lot to do with Jerry Jewell, with Jim, and creating relationships and affection and anarchy and all those things. You know, all those flaws that we all have.
Yeah. Why was Teeth? Was it
Dr. Teeth?
Yeah. Why was that? You had mentioned that was really a hard one.
It was hard for him. He did Dr. Teeth.
Yeah.
Jim did.
Yeah. Why?
Some puppets are very heavy.
Physically heavy.
Oh,
talk about that.
Oh, what?
Your hand, the feel inside the puppet and why that's important.
Yeah.
That this is me getting geeky, but like literally you talk about, if you don't mind,
how
has to feel inside and then tie it into the Dr. Thee thing if you want, but I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah. Like I said, the workshop, you know, I mean, it's a question of, you know, what's inside? Is it foam rubber or do I need a sleeve so I can get in fast? You know, because sometimes you change puppets, you don't have time, and the foam rubber can stick to you. So, and it's a special Scott rubber that's not as dense. And so that's, for instance, that's something to think about. Mm-hmm. What kind of sleeve, and the main characters anyway. And then, you know, how if the neck is connected to the body, in some characters that they are, how far is the connect connected? You know, mm-hmm. We got to find out for the hand. And there's so many, what kind of thumb grip you want? And all bespoke. Everybody has their own thing. All that has
to happen. So it's like one baseball player likes a certain kind of bat, another guy likes a certain bat.
Absolutely.
So when they're making something for Frank,
absolutely.
You know, Frank likes this kind of foam or this kind of...
Absolutely. Wow. Not foam, but certainly Frank or Billy or anybody else feels they can do a better job performing if we give them this.
Mm-hmm. And talk to me for a second about We Saw In and Of Itself, which you directed. What a great show.
Oh, you saw it?
With my son.
Oh, when did you see it?
And my wife about, I don't know, a couple months ago.
Oh, I'm so glad you saw it.
It's so great.
Thank you. I mean,
Stephen Colbert was raving about
it.
And he had him on and...
I just said Mark Hamill was there a couple of nights ago. I brought Mark there, and it was so nice to see that his mind was blown.
Well, the whole thing, you know, because we're working on a show for me, actually, an off-Broadway show based on something that I do with my act. And I brought up your show to the set designer. We're working with the set designer who's designed a couple of shows, the Late Show set and the Daily Show set. And I talked about how... the way you frame that show and the story and the look and how you have stuff going on in the set, but it's not, and it changes slightly during the course of it. And then the end blows your mind. And then the thing he does at the end with the cart, like I just, if you don't mind for 2 seconds, just telling me sort of,
sure.
That to me seems so different than everything else that you've done.
Absolutely. And
how do you get your head around that artistic? For people who don't know, it's basically a, can you describe it? Because I don't want to.
The great thing about the show is, and the reason why it's called In and Of Itself is you can't describe it.
Right.
It is in and of itself. Right. That's why it's named that.
Right.
And the more people know about it, the less they'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
But it is essentially an exploration of identity. And that sounds like it's really boring, but as you know, it's not.
No, but I mean, it's a good way of describing it without giving it away. And I think that's an accurate way to describe it.
And it gets much deeper than that. But, Derek Delgadio is a very singular performer because he doesn't perform. Mm. He just talks. Mm. And you're on the edge of your seat. Mm. The one thing I love about our audiences, and I go there every week, is that Derek is so non-presentational.
Oh, yeah.
That you can hear a pin drop. Mm. The audience is completely silent. I don't know if you experienced that, but there's often rustling and coughing. It's not the case in our show at all.
Yeah.
Because Derek is extraordinary.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's that's where my heart is, more rebellious stuff and more out there. But I somehow became a director who was, and performer who dealt with popular entertainment and is, you know.
Did I read that you wrote the score for that?
For what?
For In and of Itself, or the sort if of the music behind?
If I did, the composers can be very upset at me.
Okay.
No, it's
a collaborative effort.
Yeah, Mother. Yeah, no, we didn't write the score at all.
Oh, okay.
All right. Mark Motherbrooks, who from Devo.
Oh, days. Devo. That's yeah. Right. I'm sorry.
Mark, he did a beautiful job, and yeah, it was. You know, that's where my heart is more. Just break glass.
Yeah, it really is terrific. The issue at hand, as they say, is the Muppet Guys talking, and you can go to MuppetGuysTalking.com.
Yeah, thank you so much, because I'm a lousy seller.
No, we're going to get it all in.
But MuppetGuysTalking.com, people think they might be on Netflix, or we wanted to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
And so you can't get it anywhere else, because mm-hmm. we wanted to have a connection with our audience direct instead of having a company between us.
Yeah.
So that's why it's MuppetGuysTalking.com is the only place you can get it.
Yeah. We'll go there. It's 65 minutes. It feels like 5 minutes. My son and I were all laughing in the same places at the same time and uh-huh. stuff, and really found it really interesting.
Well, you know, you could feel part of the reason the Muppets work, and I think Muppet Guys Talking works, because you can feel the authenticity.
Hmm.
We didn't have any agenda. We just sat down and started talking.
Well, here's the other thing for me is, like, here's this, and I don't overuse this term. I meant to, I told you that you're iconic, and you are, and you can, you know, disagree or not.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
You're iconic and brilliant. Man, you're playing up the old guy I can't hear bullshit, huh? But here's this thing that's been out there from the 60s, right? And now you're...
No, things been out there since the 50s.
Oh, right.
Jim and Jane in that's Washington, right. D.C. had it for about 7 years before they moved to New York.
And you pull the curtain back, really, through this, about how this works, which is fascinating.
You saw stuff in there that you wouldn't believe, right?
No, exactly. And I don't want to give it all away.
Today they do CGI, but we didn't have that then, and we did it all... real.
But you know what comes through is that's amazing. And then what also comes through is the fun, like when you guys, somebody flubs a line, we're going to do it again.
We're merciless.
Like,
we totally try and screw each other over.
Oh, God, yeah, right? Try to go up on your lines.
Our
right?
job is to upstage the other person. That's our job.
Break each other up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
What a job to go to where you're like, you're just laughing all day.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was, really comes through.
It was great. I mean, it's hard physical work, but that comes with the territory.
Well, that's the
so
thing.
What?
How's your back and your knees and stuff?
I'm fine.
You guys are all right?
Davey's had some shoulder problems, but I'm a mutant. I'm fine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like knee pads? What do you do? How do you? Because you're kneeling a lot and all that
Not
stuff.
Kneeling a lot. We're in every single position you could think of.
Really?
But that you don't think about it. You just don't think about it. It's,
yeah.
It's painful, but you have worked. You work beyond that.
So you're limber. You're not good in bed. You must be crazy.
Well, I'm not limber, but I'm great in bed. No, I... if a woman likes somebody who's not limber.
God.
But no, I
know you're good with your hands.
There you go. Nothing else.
I don't know how far I can push the envelope.
Nothing actually moves but my hands, actually. But that comes with the territory. Yeah. It just, you don't even think about the pain.
Yeah. I wanted it to be longer. There was more I wanted to know.
Well, like I said, it sounds like I'm.
I mean, that is a good thing. You're going to like, well, what? It just is such a cool, I'm sorry, I'm like gushing here, but it's such a cool window into how this works.
I love it.
And how you guys work.
Because, it wasn't my idea. It was Victoria LaBalme's idea. She saw us together. She took about a year to convince me to do it. Finally we did it. And at the
end
of the
you
day,
said she wanted to show people how you can really work in an environment where, as namby-pamby as it sounds, you can do really great work, work like a son of a bitch, and have fun. No politics, no backstabbing, no jealousy. I joined him when I was 19, and that was every day. Victoria realized that this was a unique thing.
Exactly. Really, and I didn't know, because I thought that's how everybody
And
worked.
I'll tell people, for as somebody that's worked in TV for a while, it really is a unique thing. And also, I worked in a law firm. It's the same thing. It's a lot of politics. I remember one time a young associate going through, we would do timesheets, and you basically say, okay, I worked on Frank Oz's case today, and you write down the number of hours, and it had a code number, right? And then you got, and then you put your billable hours in. And, you know, part of the thing was a badge of honor is if you worked a lot of hours, right? Well, I didn't care. I was just working these M&A deals, whatever. And this one guy was obsessed, and he was going through one night. I could see him like rifling through pages on my desk, trying to see what my billable hours were for the month. I go, what do you go? So I just want to see what you billed. I go, you shouldn't be at my desk. You know? So it's that kind of thing. So to be in that environment, it's just incredible.
Yeah, it's not like a real Christmas elves. We're adults and we screw around a lot. But it's hard to believe. But because of Jim, it all came from Jim. We all work to one goal, and that's just doing great work.
Yeah,
I
understand Jim was leading but you guys got to give yourselves credit too.
Well, you know what?
If you weren't the right
Jim
people.
Jim chose each of us.
Right.
And so he sensed something about that.
Yeah, and you all brought something to the table. Yeah. So any advice for my son, who will be the surrogate for the youth of America, as someone that has this incredible...
Stay out of the business. Be smart.
take a nice accounting job or something. That's not gonna be. I can't tell you what a treat this is.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. You didn't really have any of your water. So
I had it all. I drank the whole thing.
Oh, Jesus, we were hoping you weren't. We're going to pour it back in the thing. MuppetGuysTalking.com, all one word, MuppetGuysTalking.com is where you will go. Not should go. You will go as soon as this is over and get the documentary. And I can't thank you enough. Go see In and of Itself, too. I'll give a plug for that because it's amazing.
Yes.
And it really is just so exciting to have you on.
Oh,
thank you.
Thanks so much.
I hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks. Thanks, Alex, for attending.
Alex, goodbye. See you guys next week. Thanks for checking it out. All right. How about that? I'm having Frank on again just to talk about directing. But to understand that... Like, I had no idea that these puppeteers put their own personalities into the characters, their insecurities, etc., or that every puppeteer has a different feel for how the puppet needs to feel inside when they're manipulating with their hand and the materials that they use. And I know I'm geeking out on you, but this guy, there's only one Frank Oz in the world. He's the voice of Yoda as well. I mean, it's incredible. So listen, this weekend, April 5th to the 8th, come out to the West Palm Beach Improv, talk, hang out. We'll have a lot of laughs. And the end of the month, I'm going to be at the Hartford Funny Bone and the Albany Funny Bone. All my tour dates are on my website, paulmercurio.com. Thanks for checking it out. I hope you enjoyed Frank as much as I did, and we'll see you next week.